So, getting started with week five on the biblical battlefields of Israel. I hope that everybody's Shavuot was inspiring and that you were able to celebrate despite all the tension and wondering, well, what's going on in Israel and so on. And for Phyllis and anybody else here who's in Israel, I hope you were able to celebrate as well. I did send out the flyer for the June course. I saw a lot of you have already signed up. Giants of Sephardic Jewry. It should be a lot of fun. It is, as is our tradition, a free series in June. So, you know, let people know. It'll be good. We have a lot to talk about in this fifth session as we talk about Elah and the fight of David and Goliath. So, let's just jump in. We talked about it a little bit at the end last time. We introduced it somewhat, talking about how this story has really stayed with people and become the emblem of what it means to be the few against the many and the small against the great, even though there are so many examples of it in Jewish history. And what I want to do as part of our discussion is to find out why this battle was so important. Important strategically back in the day and important for Jewish history moving forward from there. So, does everyone have the source sheet? I forgot. I was going to put the link in the chat for it. I'm going to do that right now so that those who do not yet have it will be able to. Okay, source sheet is now in the chat so people can pull it that way. And I'm actually going to open it up on my computer so that I can share the map so that people are all able to look at the map of the Valley of Elah together. I'm still recovering from the holiday, so I'm a little bit slow. But just a moment. All right. And so I'm going to share the map. Okay. Everyone can see that? Okay. Good. So what you're looking at is really central Israel. If you were to go further south, you'd be down in the Negev. Up north, be up in some of the areas that we've talked about actually in previous sessions. You can see off to the east here is the Dead Sea. Here you've got Jerusalem, Jericho, which was our first battlefield. On the west, you see a little bit of the Mediterranean. And of course, you see Ashdod, Ashkelon. That's actually going to be a very important area for us to discuss, aside from being so much in the headlines now. But right in the middle, courtesy of Google Maps, you see the Valley of Elah. So that is where our story is going to take place. If you want to put it in reference to previous battlefields, I already noted Jericho over here. So if you were to go somewhat north from there, you would see Ayalon. That was about here. And if you go way north, you would see Kishon, which was the last one that we talked about, the Wadi. So that should help us to be oriented a little bit. This is the events that we're going to be talking about, are from the period of the judges. We're after the period of the judges. We are about 250 years after the events of Devorah, which we read about in Kishon. So we've now moved way into the future. And the major foe of the Jews at this point in our history are the Philistines. The Philistines are sea people. They invaded Israel coming from the northwest, the area of Turkey, Greece, Crete, and they unseated both Canaanites and Jews from western Israel, and especially in the area of Gaza, or as the British called it, Gaza, which is the name that has stuck. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing the map now, but we'll come back to it, I think, in a bit. But the Philistines are referred to much earlier in the Chumash, in the Bible, much earlier than this period, and there's a lot of discussion about the relationship between that original group and this one. But the point for us is that the Philistines are the stronger party at this point in the land of Israel. They are clearly dominant. So to show you, if you take a look at the source sheet, it's source number 2. This is from an earlier battle with the Philistines, as recorded in the book of Samuel, chapter 13. And again, I'm putting the link in the chat for anyone who just joins so that they can also get the source sheet. So this is an earlier battle with the Philistines, in which Jonathan, the son of King Saul, killed a Philistine soldier. So, as recorded in the JPS translation, when all Israel heard that Saul had struck down the Philistine prefect and that Israel had incurred the wrath of the Philistines, all the people rallied to Saul at Gilgal. So the Jews are ready to fight. The Philistines, in turn, gathered to attack Israel. 30,000 chariots. Do you remember how 250 years earlier they had 900 chariots, right? And that was a big deal. Well, now you got 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops as numerous as the sands of the seashore. They marched up and encamped at Michmas, east of Beit Aven. That's going to matter. We're going to talk about Michmas a little bit later, but I'm not ready to do that right now. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the troops, the Jewish ones, were hard-pressed, the people hid in caves, among thorns, among rocks, in tunnels, and in cisterns. Some Hebrews crossed the Jordan, running away east to the territory of Gad and Gilad. Saul was still of Gilgal. The rest of the people rallied to him in alarm. So, what this is describing from an earlier period, not much earlier, just like, you know, months earlier, is that the Jews had started a battle with the Philistines. Jonathan, son of Saul, killed a Philistine soldier. The Jews all rally. They're ready to fight their Philistine oppressors until the Philistines come swarming in with 30,000 chariots and huge numbers of people. And at that point, the Jews just turn and run. They flee. They hide in any place they can hide. They cross the Jordan. And one major reason is beyond the numbers, is the fact that the Jews don't have weapons. Continuing in source number 2, no smith was to be found in all the land of Israel, meaning wherever the Jews lived, you didn't have anybody who could work metal. Why? For the Philistines were afraid that the Hebrews would make swords or spears. So all the Israelites had to go down to the Philistines to have their plowshares, mattocks, axes, and coulters sharpened. You had to go get the Philistines in order to do it. The only Jew who had a sword or a spear, Saul and Jonathan. King Saul and his son Jonathan are the only ones with proper weapons. Everybody else, makeshift. So the Jews don't have weapons, and they don't have numbers. That's something that you need to be cognizant of, you know, when you're looking at this. Now, the Jews win that battle, that earlier battle, miraculously in Michmas. And here I'm going to show you the map once again, because it's important to recognize where Michmas is in relation to where Elah is. I didn't note it for you on the map, but Michmas is north-northeast of Jerusalem, approximately here. You see that? Okay, where my arrow is. That's where Michmas is. Whereas, and the Jews defeat the Philistines at Michmas. They drive the Philistines west. So far west that the battle now, that we're going to read about months later, takes place in the valley of Elah. So the Philistines have been driven back towards Aza, which is their base in the west. And now now they're going to end up fighting the Jews in the middle. The Philistines come back for this new round of battle, for reasons that we're going to talk about. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing the map. Everyone good? I think I scared everybody by telling you we have so much to cover, and so no one's unmuting, no one's speaking. Yes, Rosalind.
So, I just wanted to know, please, when we talked about Samson a few months ago, where would that battle have been?
Good. Okay, so I'm going to share the map again.
Okay.
Right. When we had our Samson series and we talked about his fight against the Philistines, that was actually way down here. Well, actually, not way down. Not that far down. It would have been here. if you see where, like, Kiryat Malachi is on the map.
Yeah.
So you're talking about somewhere roughly there. The reason I say that is we know that he was right by Philistine territory. You know, some of his stories actually take place in Philistine territory, particularly the city of Azza, which isn't marked on this map. It's further here. But the but he was on the border between the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Dan. And the tribe of Judah was basically the entire Negev all the way up to Jerusalem. The top of their portion is an east-west line that's basically the Jerusalem latitude. So he would have been about here. Oh, you know what? It is marked on the map. I take that back. You see Eshta'ol?
Huh?
Eshta'ol is one of the cities that Samson is identified between Sar'a and Eshta'ol. So he was actually here, east of where I had originally marked him. I had put him closer to Azza, but he's not. He's over here.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's launch into the story itself of this battle in chapter 17. And what we're going to do is first read through the story itself. Then we're going to talk about the location where it takes place and why it took place there. And then we'll talk about the battle of David and Goliath and is it a miracle at all? And if it is, why? Why is it necessary to have a miracle then? But take a look first at source number 3. That starts us off.
Can I just ask one question?
Sure, Rose.
If I'm right, how did they win this war? How did they drive them out? They had nothing.
Right. And the answer is entirely miraculous. If you go back through chapter 13 and chapter 14, it's basically Jonathan, son of Saul, acting on faith and choosing to rout first a Philistine garrison, and then that snowballs into a defeat of the Philistines as a whole. But yeah, the text credits it as a miracle. So, source number 3. The Philistines assembled their forces for battle. Right? The Philistines trigger this war. They massed at Socho of Judah and encamped at Ephes Damim between Socho and Azekah. I'm not going to go through all of these individual places, some of which we know, some of which we don't, because what matters is the next line. Saul and the men of Israel massed and encamped in the valley of Elah. They drew up their line of battle against the Philistines, with the Philistines stationed on one hill, Israel stationed on the opposite hill, the ravine was between them. So you have soldiers on each side, and then the valley in the middle. There's some debate about this, because it's unclear why armies would climb mountains at all. You know, especially if your main weapon is a chariot, you have no reason to go up on a mountain. So Rabbi David Kimchi, Radak, suggests that it wasn't so. It's that each army had outposts on top of the mountains, like a, you know, lookout type thing. But not that the armies themselves all climb mountains. That doesn't make any sense. Professor Yehuda Kiel, in the Dot Mikra edition of Samuel, notes that the place called Ephes Damim is known in other Jewish sources as Chakal Sumakta, which means the red field. And that fits passages in the Talmud about it. And he points out there is a place in Emek Ha'elah, in the Elah Valley, with red clay. It's actually known as Al-Khamra, which makes sense, because Khamra in Aramaic and Arabic could be clay. So there was an area there with red clay, and that's probably this place, Ephes Damim. But they're in the Valley of Elah. You've got armies on both sides. And then you see source number 4. A champion of the Philistine forces stepped forward. His name was Goliath, or Goliath, of Gat. Gat being a Philistine city. And he was 6 cubits and a span tall. 6 cubits and a span. So so what exactly does that look like in our numbers? So there's a lot of debate as to the exact measure of a cubit. But a standard measure of a cubit is that it is 21.6 inches, making 6 amma 129.6 inches. If someone wants to do the metric, translation and share it, that's fine. But what you're talking about is that plus a span, The span is relatively small number. All told, what you're saying is that this fellow is somewhere around 11 feet tall. Which is tall, you know, as people go. So that's the description here of this massive, very tall human being. He is described as a champion. The word in the Hebrew is Ish HaBeinayim. Anyone want to hazard a translation for Ish HaBeinayim that would be more literal than champion?
Middleman.
Middleman, right. The man in the middle. The man who stood between the camps. That's the idea of champion is he is going to be a representative of the Philistines. Professor Keel notes that this was a military role in which you would have some warrior who would venture forth to attack the other side before the main battle. So he steps forward, and not only does he have size, but he's got weapons. He had a bronze helmet on his head, wore a breastplate of scale armor, a bronze breastplate weighing 5,000 shekels. That's also known as heavy. He had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung from his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's bar, and the iron head of his spear weighed 600 shekels. And the shield bearer marched in front of him. The reason why you need a shield bearer is simply because this stuff is heavy. Based on archaeological finds, a shekel would have been about 12 grams. Which means his armor weighs about 60 kilo. The spear alone is 7 or 8 kilo. This guy, I mean, look, he's 11 feet tall. He can do stuff. But yes, you need a shield bearer to walk forward, carrying this. So he stopped, and he called out to the ranks of Israel, and he said to them, "Why should you come out to engage in battle? I am the Philistine." They add in the word champion in the brackets, but it's not in the Hebrew. He says, "I am the Philistine, and you are Saul's servants. Choose one of your men. Let him come down against me. If he bests me in combat and kills me, we will become your slaves. But if I best him and kill him, you shall be our slaves and serve us." Now, that's not actually a serious offer. The way we know it's not a serious offer is from the fact that after David kills Goliath, the Philistines don't become servants of the Jews. It doesn't work that way. So he's just talking. He says, "Look, send forth your guy. I'll fight him. And then you can become our slaves when I kill him." That's basically it. There's no thought in his mind that anybody's going to be able to beat him. He's got armor. He's got weapons. He's got size. Who in the world is going to be able to do anything to this guy? Rose puts a note in the chat about a potential disorder that leads someone to be this tall and this large. So we're going to get there. Susan's laughing because she was in a class where we learned this. So we're going to get to that. As the text ends in source number 4, and the Philistine ended, "I herewith defy the ranks of Israel. Get me a man and let's fight it out." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and terror-stricken. You think? So, that's our opening to the battle. On the other side, we now have David. David is already known to the reader of the book of Samuel. He has already emerged in chapter 16 as somebody who is actually anointed by the prophet Samuel in secret, who's going to be the replacement for King Saul, but that's not public information yet. He's been described as being brilliant, he's been described as someone who is very strong, and he's also been described as somebody who has God on his side, which is the most relevant part for this. So take a look at source number 5. "David was the son of a certain Ephratite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse." Ephratite is a term that sometimes means a person of standing, like part of the nobility. If you read Ruth on Shavuot, you saw the term come in there as well. He had 8 sons, and in the day, he was Jesse, not David. And in the days of Saul, the man was already old, advanced in years. Jesse was already very old. The three oldest sons of Jesse had left and gone with Saul to the war. The names of his three sons who had gone to the war were Eliab, the firstborn, the next Abinadab, and the third Shammah, and David was the youngest. So David's the youngest of eight. The three oldest had followed Saul, and David would go back and forth from attending on Saul to shepherd his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistines stepped forward morning and evening and took his stand for 40 days. What it means that David was attending on Saul is subject to dispute. In chapter 16, we found that King Saul, well, let me go back a step. This isn't so relevant for our direct discussion here, but it's important to know in general. King Saul at this stage is deteriorating. In chapter 13, he chose not to follow an instruction from the prophet Samuel. In chapter 15, he disobeyed another instruction from the prophet Samuel, and as a result, God told him, "You're losing the throne. I'm giving it to somebody else who's better than you." Someone sent me a message asking for the Hebrew name of Jesse. It is Yishai. So they, so Saul knows he's losing the throne, and God abandons Saul. Whereas previously Saul had some kind of feeling of proximity and closeness to God, now he is aware that that has left him. And Saul starts to experience states of what is called in the Hebrew, Ruach Ra, a bad spirit, which Don Isaac Abarbanel and other classic commentators rendered as some form of depression that he experiences. And it is alleviated when David plays music for him. David is brought before him in chapter 16 to be a musician. And that helps mitigate Saul's problem. So that may be what David is doing here, attending Saul, may be a reference to playing music for him. Alternatively, it's what we're going to see right here, which is that he brings supplies to the military camp. Either way, David is going back and forth between being a shepherd and going to the battlefield. The Philistines stepped forward morning and evening and took his stand for 40 days. Jesse said to his son David, "Take an ephah of this parched corn." Corn doesn't mean corn. Corn means grain. They weren't having corn there. This was grain. But take the term corn, I think, in German is grain. So the take an ephah, which is a large volume measure, of this grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers, and carry them quickly to your brothers in camp. Take these 10 cheeses to the captain of their thousand. Find out how your brothers are and bring some token from them. So there's a lot of dispute as to this translation, and there are different ways to translate the Hebrew. Not so relevant for our immediate discussion. Although, why would they be bringing cheese for the captain? Why are they bringing, yeah, Esther?
Make him sleep to the captain? Doesn't cheese make sick or something like that? I just remember from another story.
I mean, if he's lactose intolerant, no, the cheese would have been, Esther, what you're remembering is from the story with Yael. We've talked about it in Kishon, and dairy putting the fellow to sleep. But no, it was a gift to the officer who's in charge of their unit. Ralbag, one of the classic commentators, says it's to curry favor on behalf of the family, right? These sons, you got three sons serving in his unit. So you give a gift to the commanding officer. So David is told, bring this stuff out to the battlefield. And David's a good boy, so he does. Saul and the brothers and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah in the war against the Philistines. We're still in source number 5 in the second paragraph of it. Early next morning, David left someone in charge of the flock, took the provisions, and set out as his father Jesse had instructed him. He reached the barricade as the army was going out to the battle lines shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up their battle lines opposite each other. David left his baggage with the man in charge of the baggage and ran toward the battle line and went to greet his brothers. So all the stuff he brought, right? The grain, the cheese, all of that he leaves with the fellow who is watching the supplies. And he runs out to the battle line, goes to his brothers. Okay. That brings us to source number 6. While he was talking to them, while David is talking to his brothers, the champion, whose name was Goliath, the Philistine of Gath, stepped forward from the Philistine ranks and spoke the same words as before. Right? This guy stands there all day long taunting the Jews. We said that he went out morning and evening, but he would go out in the morning. He's there all day long, and in the evening he goes home. So this fellow, the Philistine, comes forward and speaks the same words we already read. And David heard him. When the men of Israel saw the man, they fled in terror. And the men of Israel were saying among themselves, "Do you see that man coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The man who kills him will be rewarded by the king with great riches. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and grant exemption," meaning tax exemption, "to his father's house in Israel." That's what they say. Now, it's not clear that Saul had ever actually said this. While we do find that Saul will offer David to marry his daughter, it seems to be disconnected from this. And so some of the commentators say this was just what people were saying. It wasn't that Saul had said this, but everyone said, like, this is, you know, how in the world are we going to beat this guy? If anybody could actually do it, the king is going to reward him very, very handsomely. So David is interested. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills that Philistine and removes the disgrace from Israel? Who is that uncircumcised Philistine that he dares defy the ranks of the living God?" The troops told him in the same words what will be done for the man who killed him. Yes, Mickey.
At the risk of spoiling the story, there are other commentaries that say that David was an obvious winner from the word go, just based on the difference in the type of fighting that they did.
So, right,
David was a marksman from a distance.
So we're going to get there. Not to worry. We're going to see that. I mean, that's not from a classic commentary. It's Malcolm Gladwell. You'll see it in source number 13. Unfortunately, there are some holes in his narrative. But we'll go in order. We are going to see that, because to me, that's the highlight of this conversation, is exactly what you're pointing out. Is David truly the underdog in this fight? So David is very excited. And he says, we gotta get this guy. Not because of the reward. In fact, when David is offered the opportunity in the next chapter to marry Saul's daughter, he declines. He's not interested in the reward. But David is so angry that this guy is coming out here and defying the ranks of the living God, as he put it here. So when Eliab, the oldest brother, hears David speaking to the men, Eliab became angry with David and said, "Why did you come down here? With whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your impudence and your impertinence. You came down to watch the fighting." Hey, what are you doing here? Remember, David left the cheese and the grain in the camp. So all Eliab sees is his kid brother, who's supposed to be watching the sheep, and he's like, puts him down, like, "Yeah, you watch a few sheep. What are you doing here?" But David replied, "What have I done now? I was only asking. I'm just being good." David is not intimidated at all by Goliath. And that's really important to remember. And you'll see the way that it's presented is his confidence in God. That's the way that he himself is going to speak of it. But we'll get there. Eliab, the older brother, could be understood in a couple of different ways. Either you take him straight as the jealous and angry older brother, right, who already knows that David has been anointed to be the next king. So maybe he's not so happy about that. That's one way to take him. Alternatively, more benignly, he is protective. He doesn't want his younger brother shooting off his mouth and putting himself in a position where he's going to get killed. Right? You're the older brother. Can you imagine having to explain to Jesse what happened? So he's just like, go home, stay out of the way. That's what he says. Well, David is not interested in staying out of the way. Take a look at source number 7. And he, David, turned away from him, Eliab, towards someone else. He asked the same question. Hey, what's going to happen if you beat this guy? Why isn't anybody fighting him? And the troops gave him the same answer as before. The things David said were overheard and were reported to Saul. Because there probably were not too many people saying things like this. Well, Saul has him brought over. David said to Saul, let no man's courage fail him. Your servant will go and fight the Philistine. But Saul said to David, you can't go to that Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy. He's been a warrior from his youth. Who are you kidding? David replied to Saul, your servant has been tending his father's sheep. If a lion or bear came and carried off an animal from the flock, I would go after it and fight it and rescue it from its mouth. And if it attacked me, I would seize it by the beard and strike it down and kill it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and that uncircumcised Philistine shall end up like one of them, for he has defied the ranks of the living God. The Lord, David went on, who saved me from lion and bear, will also save me from that Philistine. So David's having none of it. He says, this guy is nothing. I can beat lions and bears? I can beat him too. Now, a lion and a bear, even if you fight them both at the same time, which commentators note here David seems to be saying, when you read through the Hebrew, it sounds like he actually fights them both simultaneously, but still, the guy's 11 feet tall. He's got armor. He's got weapons. He's a warrior. He's not an animal. So commentators discuss what David is trying to say here, and they suggest perhaps that what he's saying is that Goliath is, as the wording went in the translation, like one of them. Meaning, he's just an animal. I'm not worried about him. David is willing to go fight him. Well, flipping the page, then go, Saul said to David, and may the Lord be with you. Saul clothed David in his own garment. He placed a bronze helmet on his head, fastened a breastplate on him. David girded his sword over his garments. So David is going to have weapons. David is going to have armor. He's not going to Goliath with nothing. Except, then he tried to walk, but he wasn't used to it. And David said to Saul, I can't walk in these. I'm not used to them. So David took them off. He has now removed the protection that he had. There are lots of explanations for why he did this. The commentators all struggle to understand what in the world he thought he was doing. But really, at bottom, it comes down to his faith. He believes he is on a mission. He believes that he has God with him. And he's not scared to go up against Goliath with nothing. Clear so far? We're good? Yes, Marilyn.
Oh, you could say he had the arrogance of youth as well.
So there definitely is a confidence there. I would stop short of saying arrogance just because of the way we see him conduct himself in general, which is in a more humble way. But he definitely believes he's winning. Like, he has no doubt that he's winning. So take a look at source number 8. He took his stick, picked a few smooth stones from the wadi, put them in the pocket of his shepherd's bag, and sling in hand, he went toward the Philistine. Now, JPS really wants to make this readable, and so they do a lot with the Hebrew to smooth over some problems and to leave out details. I don't like when they do it, honestly. We could spend a lot of time, you know, those of you who have the sheet from last time, I gave you the links for like 8 sessions that I taught about this story. But just on a basic level, there were 5 stones. It's not a few. He took 5 stones. Like, there's a very specific number that is used, which we're not going to really get into, but they just say, a few. But the other thing I wanted you to see, and I'm going to share it with you on the screen, and this goes back towards Mickey's point about David's status here, is that these stones that we're talking about are not a few stones from the river, think like something you'd go skipping. This is a picture from the Lachish Museum of sling stones. Okay? These are not pebbles. These are not small. So something to just be aware of is that this is not an insignificant weapon. It's still not enough against an 11-foot tall guy wearing armor, but it's not nothing. Got it? Okay. I was going to put those on the source sheet, but I forgot to, so at least you saw them this way. But you can look online. I got that picture from worldhistory.org. Is where I got that. Okay. So he's got his five stones, puts them in his shepherd's bag. He's got his stick, and he goes towards the Philistine. The Philistine, meanwhile, was coming closer to David, preceded by his shield bearer. When the Philistine caught sight of David, he scorned him, for he was but a boy, ruddy and handsome. And JPS is biasing you here. What the Hebrew says is admoni, a person who is red. Doesn't say whether that means attractive or not attractive. So the commentators go in two different directions. One view, Rabbi Kimchi, is like what JPS does here. He says it means attractive, and the idea is you're a pretty boy. You're not a warrior. That's one take. The other take is that being ruddy, being of red skin, reflected someone who was impulsive, fiery character. This idea that it reflects his personality, and that he's somebody who is likely to attempt something he can't possibly achieve. So, two different schools of thought. And the Philistine called out to David, "Am I a dog that you come against me with sticks?" He apparently doesn't notice the sling, maybe because David put the rocks in his bag, or he doesn't think it's a danger. The Philistine cursed David by his gods, and the Philistine said to David, "Come here, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." David replied to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the ranks of Israel, whom you have defied. This very day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I will kill you and cut off your head, and I will give the carcasses of the Philistine camp to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth. All the earth shall know that there is a God in Israel, and this whole assembly shall know that the Lord can give victory without sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will deliver you into our hands." This is the David we have already met in the book, who believes always that God is on his side. "You don't like my choice of weapon, that I come to you with a stick? I don't need your sword, I don't need your shield, I don't need your javelin. I can do just fine." So David says. And of course, the way the story plays out is that David is correct. Source number 9. When the Philistine began to advance toward him again, David quickly ran up to the battle line to face the Philistine. David put his hand into the bag. He took out a stone and slung it. It struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. Thus David bested the Philistine with sling and stone. He struck him down and killed him. David had no sword, so David ran up and stood over the Philistine, grasped his sword, pulled it from its sheath, and with it he dispatched him and cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that their warrior was dead, they ran. Then they don't agree to the terms that Goliath had offered, that they're going to become the slaves of the Jews. The men of Israel and Judah rose up with a war cry. They pursued the Philistines all the way to Gai and up to the gates of Ekron, another of the Philistine cities. So there's a lot more that happens after this, but I'm pausing our read of the text at this point. Everyone's clear on the text? Okay, story is as, you know, roughly as people have heard it over the years. Okay. So let's talk first about the location and then talk about the miracle. I could read the story as a simple duel, right? You have a showdown between the giant Philistine and the Jew on the other side. But the location itself is significant. And I refer you to source number 10 on the sheet. This is, again, from that set of map books from the IDF from 1963. This fellow, Joshua Levinson, in an article in there called "The Transition from the Shephelah to the Mountains." And what he says is this. The Elah Valley is about 10 kilometers southwest of Mount Tov. The valley was formed from the channels of two streams, between the Tarkumia or Trichomia Valley and Beit Natif. This is a broad and fertile valley, protected in ancient times by the Azekah fortress, tells Zechariah. From here ascends the road to Bethlehem and Jerusalem. In the Elah Valley, between Azekah and Socho, the battle of intermediaries between David and Goliath took place. In truth, the foothills of the mountain was the main area of the battles between the Philistines and the children of Israel. So he makes a couple of points here. Number one, this area is towards the foothills that will lead into Hare Yehuda, the Judean mountains. I'm going to share the map again. So if you think of the Judean mountains, right, Jerusalem being in the mountains, this is in the foothills that lead up there, right? So I saw an article from about 10 years ago in the Jerusalem Post, which pointed out something interesting. It was actually written by a fellow who I think may be a pastor, Wayne Stiles. The original battle from chapter 13 that they fought was way up here. The Philistines were driven back. What happens at this point is that the Philistines want to recapture the middle, because that is, as we noted, the path to Bethlehem, the path to Jerusalem. All the roads are going to go through this middle area. In other words, this is a battle for control of a key passage that determines the flow of battle between the Philistines, whose base is here, and the Jews, whose base is here. It's the very important middle ground. That's why this becomes so important, which is also why, if you look back at your sheets now, source number 11, from the follow-up to this battle, David goes on a tour of the country with King Saul. And look at what happens. When the troops came home and David returned from killing the Philistine, the women of all the towns of Israel came out singing and dancing to greet King Saul with timbrels, shouting, and sistrums, also a musical instrument. Everyone is celebrating because this was a key moment in that they had been able to hold the center of the country. There's more to be said about that, but I want to get to the miracle. So, yeah, we've talked about a lot of different miracles. We've talked about hailstones and a flash flood in Kishon. We talked about the walls of Jericho collapsing, right? We talked about the sun and the moon stopping or not stopping in Ayalon, depending on whose read of the story we gave. Well, here, clearly, the miracle is supposed to be David versus Goliath. And here, Mickey, I come to Malcolm Gladwell, who argues on the basis of research done in the last 50 years or so that it was not a miracle. I gave you a link to a video of his in source number 12 where he talks about this. When I taught this as part of a multi-week thing, I actually went through his video bit by bit, but it would take longer than we have. So I'm using his writing instead. He has a range of mistakes in his read of the biblical text, some of which we're not going to get to because they're not directly relevant. So, for example, in his record of the story, he says that there had been a showdown and a face-off for 40 days, and neither side was winning, and therefore Goliath came out. Whereas you read the text itself, and you saw Goliath was there from the beginning, and he was taunting the Jews for 40 days before David showed up. So there are mistakes like that that aren't immediately relevant to our piece. I'm just sticking to what's relevant for us. So take a look at source number 13, which I brought you from his introduction to David and Goliath, his book. Saul objected, "You cannot go against this Philistine to do battle with him, for you are a lad, and he is a man of war from his youth." But the shepherd was adamant. He had faced more ferocious opponents than this, he argued. When the lion or the bear would come and carry off a sheep from the herd, he told Saul, "I would go after him and strike him down and rescue it from his clutches." So what he says is that David's argument is, "I defended my flock, I can take him." Was that David's argument?
No, he's trying to prove that God is with him, don't worry.
Yes. He mentioned that he had survived the lion and the bear, but go back and look at the text and you'll see that he mentioned it in a very particular way. Back to source number 7. He said, the Lord who saved me from lion and bear will also save me from that Philistine. Right? So that's...
faith.
I'm sorry?
I say his premise is faith.
Yes. His premise is faith in God, not faith in himself. That's number one. But let's go on in Gladwell. He says, slinging took an extraordinary amount of skill and practice. But in experienced hands, the sling was a devastating weapon. Paintings from medieval times show slingers hitting birds in mid-flight. Irish slingers were said, it sounds like a drink, were said to be able to hit a coin from as far away as they could see it. And in the Old Testament book of Judges, slingers are described as being accurate within a hair's breadth. And that is correct. There's no doubt that they were dangerous. An experienced slinger could kill or seriously injure a target at a distance of up to 200 yards. The Romans even had a special set of tongs made just to remove stones that had been embedded in some poor soldier's body by a sling. Imagine standing in front of a Major League Baseball pitcher as he aims a baseball at your head. That's what facing a slinger was like. Only what was being thrown was not a ball of cork and leather, but a solid rock. He has more to say. He describes David running towards Goliath. He says he runs toward Goliath because without armor he has speed and maneuverability. He puts a rock into his sling and whips it around and around, faster and faster at 6 or 7 revolutions per second, aiming his projectile at Goliath's forehead, the giant's only point of vulnerability. Eitan Hirsch, a ballistics expert with the IDF, recently did a series of calculations showing that a typical size stone hurled by an expert slinger at a distance of 35 meters would have hit Goliath's head with a velocity of 34 meters per second, more than enough to penetrate his skull and render him unconscious or dead. In terms of stopping power, that is equivalent to a fair-size modern handgun. We find, Hirsch writes, that David could have slung and hit Goliath in little more than 1 second, a time so brief that Goliath would not have been able to protect himself and during which he would be stationary for all practical purposes. He also has another argument, which he does not bring in his introduction. He brings it in a footnote, or really an endnote, which is a contention that some have that the rocks in that area were made of barium sulfate, which is very dense. So that would add to the danger from the stone. And then he gets to the point that Rose mentioned. What many medical experts now believe, in fact, when he says many, there are a few writers on this, I think he's exaggerating a little bit with the many, is that Goliath had a serious medical condition. He looks and sounds like someone suffering from what is called acromegaly, a disease caused by a benign tumor of the pituitary gland. The tumor causes an overproduction of human growth hormone, which would explain Goliath's extraordinary size. The tallest person in history, Robert Wadlow, suffered from acromegaly. At his death, he was 8 foot 11 inches and apparently still growing. And furthermore, one of the common side effects of acromegaly is vision problems. Pituitary tumors can grow to the point where they compress the nerves leading to the eyes, with the result that people with acromegaly often suffer from severely restricted sight and diplopia, or double vision. Why was Goliath led onto the valley floor by an attendant? Because the attendant was his visual guide. Why does he move so slowly? Because the world around him is a blur. Why does it take him so long to understand that David has changed the rules, that David is going to fight from far away? Because he doesn't see David until David is up close. Come to me that I may give your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, he shouts out. And in that request, there is a hint of his vulnerability. I need you to come to me because I cannot locate you otherwise. And then there is the otherwise inexplicable. Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? David had only one stick. Goliath saw two. What the Israelites saw from high on the ridge was an intimidating giant. In reality, the very thing that gave the giant his size was also the source of his greatest weakness. There is an important lesson in that for battles with all kinds of giants, the powerful and the strong are not always what they seem. That's his pitch. It sounds really good, right? It sounds really impressive until you realize the violence he's done to the text in order to get there. The first of all, he paints David as being very confident, but we've already noted, he says, God saved me from the lion, right? Not that, that he did it with his own prowess. But he paints Goliath as vulnerable. Number one, is Goliath depicted in the text as slow?
Cumbersome.
Cumbersome, yeah, because he's wearing heavy armor. But there's nowhere in the text that he was described as being slow. Is the aid leading Goliath, as described in the text? The aid is a shield bearer.
He's following him.
Yeah, he's not leading. He's following, and he's carrying a shield. The further to the same point, he gave two explanations that are contradictory for Goliath saying, "Come to me." On the one hand, he said, come to me means he wants to fight at close quarters, like infantry. On the other hand, he says, come to me means I can't see you. But most of all, the biggest point in all of this, or not the biggest point, but the second biggest point in all of this is the Philistines put him out there as their warrior. Granted, he's tall, but would you put out there as your champion somebody who can't see and can't move?
If he was that big, yes, because it would intimidate the other side. They're saber rattling, both of them.
But it doesn't get you anywhere if you put him out there as your actual representative for battle. It's one thing to say, let's keep him in our lines and frighten them. But putting him out there as the guy in the middle who's going to actually fight the Jew doesn't make any sense at all.
The truth is that you can have this acromegaly with the problems without having everything. It doesn't always have to be a full-blown picture. So he could have been acromegalic, gigantic, and he didn't have to have diplopia. I mean, it's
right.
a matter of degree.
Right. No, absolutely. But everybody in this text, and this is the most important point in the story, acromegaly or not, is that the text itself, and this speaks to the point that Paul just put in the chat, the text itself believes that this is an underdog story. For Gladwell to be correct means the text doesn't understand the story that it is telling, even though it's giving you all the pieces that he's going to use, that Gladwell is going to use. Meaning, Saul says, there's no way that you can fight him, right? He is this established warrior. There's no way you can fight him. The text emphasizes repeatedly David's youth, the fact that he's not even a regular at the battlefield, his lack of stature among his own brothers. It emphasizes the size difference. It emphasizes the weapon difference. The text clearly believes it's building up what we think of as a David and Goliath story. It emphasizes his lack of armor by giving us this whole back and forth with Saul about it. It emphasizes Goliath laughing at David, mocking his appearance. It emphasizes that he doesn't have a sword, and therefore he has to use Goliath's own sword in order to cut off his head. And the evidence saying something like, you come at me with sticks. Ha, he said sticks too. Come on. The fact that he came at you with a stick was what led you to say, you're coming at me with sticks. It doesn't mean that he actually sees two sticks. Now, in truth, there are comments from traditional commentators regarding the stone piercing the helmet that do try to reduce the miracle somewhat. So they'll say things like, well, Goliath's helmet slipped. But even that, if you know, Gladwell said that that this was Goliath's point of vulnerability, his forehead. He actually had a helmet on his forehead. Go back to the text. Hang on one second. When we read his armor, right, he had a helmet. Back in source number, he had a bronze helmet on his head. It's not like his forehead should really be exposed. My point is to say that traditional commentators did wrestle with the question of just how much of a miracle is it? Was it that his helmet slipped? Was it that this went through the metal? Was there a miracle in that regard? But overall, the clear message of the story, the intent of the story, is that Goliath is defeated miraculously. And here I want to show you, and we're going down to the wire here with this one. But The message of the story is that this miracle is significant, not because it gets rid of Goliath. Goliath isn't the point. Goliath, for even if he's an experienced warrior, didn't even show up in earlier accounts of battles between the Jews and the Philistines. He's a non-entity as far as we are concerned. The focus of this story, number one, for the Jews themselves, may be Eilat as the center of the country, and therefore this is an important battle. But really, it's about God selecting David over Saul. Because the person Goliath wanted to fight was not David. Goliath wanted to fight Saul. If you go back into the text, the beginning of the story, in the end of source number 4, right? He said, I am the Philistine, and you are Saul's servants. You are Saul's servants. It's me against Saul. And he says, choose for yourselves an ish. Choose an ish, a man, which is the term that is used when Saul is introduced. He is introduced as an ish. He is introduced as a man. We're told, ein ish tov mimenu. There is no greater ish. Not only that, if you take a look at source number 14, Saul was the tallest of the Jews. He was a head taller than any of the people. So it should have been Goliath versus Saul. But Saul is sick at this stage. He feels that God has abandoned him. And so he won't go out. Which, according to some commentators, is why he offers his own armor to David. Because David is taking his place. So Saul says, at least go out wearing my armor. And when David succeeds with a miracle, at that point it broadcasts a message to the Jews, God has chosen David over Saul. You follow? Which is why the last source I show you here, in source number 15, look at the reaction to the victory. The women sang as they danced and they chanted, Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. There are a lot of ways to take that line, whether it's really meant to be translated the way JPS did. It sounds like it's praising David more than Saul. But my focus is not what the women sang, my focus is the next line. Saul was much distressed and greatly vexed about the matter, for he said, to David they have given tens of thousands, to me they have given thousands, all he lacks is the kingship. From that day on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. This story can be understood on many levels. And yes, I agree with Paul's note in the chat. Gladwell's last line is a good one about giants and the powerful and the strong are not always what they seem. For sure true. This is a story, yes, a duel between David and Goliath. This is a story about a strategic place in Israel and a battle that the Philistines rush into to try to regain ground they lost, and the Jews feeling very much under threat, very much under the gun, until David rescues them from Goliath. It's a much bigger story, though, because it's a story of transition. From this point forward, David's rise is inevitable, and Saul's decline is inevitable. This is the pivot between them, and that's what makes this miracle so important in the long term. I'm sticking around for questions and comments, so don't worry, but I just want to show you the review questions. Goliath's offer to the Jews, if I lose, we become your slaves. Your champion loses, you're our slaves. How does the text highlight David's unlikely status as a warrior? It presents him as an errand boy. He's mocked by his older brother, Eliav. He's mocked by Goliath. He has no weapons. He has no armor. No experience besides being a shepherd. Eilat is important, as we said, because the Philistines have been routed from their eastern position. And now they're trying to regain access to the Judean mountains via these foothills. Malcolm Gladwell explains David's victory via the power of a sling and Goliath's acromegaly. The text undermines the theory, as David doesn't take credit at all for the sling and instead says it's about God. The evidence for acromegaly is not in the text itself, like the line about the sticks. or about needing a shield bear, needing a somebody to lead him. And the text overall presents David as an underdog empowered by God. And why is David's miracle important in the long term? It's the demonstration that God has chosen what would become the Davidic dynasty. Thank you very much, and thank you for holding questions and comments so that we could get through this in an hour. I'm going to stick around now, so please, any thoughts? Yes, Nancy.
It's ironic in number 7 that we hear that Saul, quote, Saul clothed David in his own garment.
Yes. Well, yeah, I think that's because he feels David is doing what he ought to have done. I definitely think that that's what's going on. And he's clothing. He's the king. But he's doing it personally. Very much agreed. Yes, Rosalind.
So one thing is, you showed us those, I mean, I always thought it was a little pebble that you sort of fling into the water. So those stones that you showed us are like boulders. So first of all, if David is just a boy, I mean, he must be strong as anything. He must have, you know, the back of 10 people, because first of all, he has to put them into his, I don't know, whatever his bag.
Yep.
So he would be weighted down unless his back was made out of iron. And perhaps he's not that, he's incredibly strong. If he can sling those things around and fling them, I'm not saying he's like Goliath, but he's more than just a little boy. He's strong and he's capable.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. The text does not present David as someone who has no place at a battlefield. He very clearly does, and we'll see it in his career. He has a military career until his men finally tell him, we don't want you endangering yourself by being on the front lines. He's a fighter, and he says, I fought the lion and the bear. Notice he says, he doesn't say, I fought the lion and the bear by slinging stones at them. He says, I fought the lion and the bear. I grabbed the lion by its beard. So he's a wrestler, David. And absolutely, these stones, I mean, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration to call them a boulder. If you take a look at the picture that I sent, if you go to the Lachish Museum, picture, you can get a better sense of scale. They're probably just based on, I saw a picture which had them opposite a hand. So, you know, they fit in the palm of a hand. They're not boulders. But at the same time, they're not nothing. They're definitely not nothing. And that's why you see among the classic commentators, I'm not talking about somebody modern coming in to rewrite the story. Among the classic commentators, they do wrestle with how much of this should be attributed to David's strength and acumen and ability, and how much of it is about the miracle. But the emphasis here overall, despite the fact that he has the stones, and despite the fact that he has the shepherd experience, you know, the way that people present it, the way that Saul presents it, the way that David presents it, is this is a guy who still should not be able to win. They're all shocked that he wins, even though he has certain skills and certain strength and certain weapons, in his own right.
Are there lions in the Middle East?
Yes. I actually looked it up, and the bear is a Syrian brown bear, probably. I looked it up when I first learned the story, and yes. Yes, Mickey.
Hi,